And you are listening to Living Room on KPFA 94.1 FM. My name is C.S. Sung. It's the age of empire, the U.S. empire, of course, pursuing its global agenda without anything close to a military rival. Full-spectrum dominance is not a phrase out of some techno thriller, but the name for this administration's military agenda. To maintain and occasionally show off a military so powerful that it deters any other nation from even thinking of challenging American hegemony anywhere in the world. But if empire is the name of the game, inextricably tied up with empire is capitalism, with its ability, via trade agreements, multinational companies, and policies like structural adjustment, to wriggle or force its way into the far reaches of the globe, opening up new markets and otherwise imposing its economic imperatives. Which brings us to the question, what happens when capital and empire, that is, capitalism and imperialism, come together? What defines the peculiar kind of empire we see today? How did it originate? And how, if at all, is this empire vulnerable to resistance or even defeat? Well, today, to answer these questions, we bring you a distinguished left thinker, someone Sasha and I have been pursuing for quite some time. Ellen Maxens Wood is an award-winning critic and former political science professor at York University in Toronto. Among her highly acclaimed books are The Origin of Capitalism, published 4 years ago but already a classic, and The Retreat from Class, which won the Deutscher Prize. Her latest book, just out from Verso Press, is entitled Empire of Capital. Yesterday, we talked on tape with Ellen Maxens Wood by phone from the UK, where she now lives. I began by asking her to describe the distinguishing features of capitalism as an economic system.
I think the essential characteristic is that all or the major economic actors are market dependent. But, I mean, critically, this means that the relationship between classes is also mediated by the market, so that, unlike pre-capitalist systems in which exploiting classes were able to extract surplus labor from exploited classes by means of superior power, in capitalism, the imperatives are economic imperatives. So, for example, the wage laborer has to sell his labor power to a capitalist simply in order to gain access to the means of his own life, his own labor, and so on. And the capitalist doesn't need to have superior political, legal, or military power over him. And the whole system is operated by these economic imperatives.
And when we talk about economics, some people would assume that commerce or trade in goods constitutes capitalism. What's your response to that?
Well, I make a distinction between market opportunities and market imperatives. And I think it's only in capitalism that you have a system in which people are obliged or compelled to enter the market simply to guarantee their own existence and their own self-reproduction. I mean, there have been markets throughout history in which people have brought their surpluses to sell and so on, but there's never been a system before capitalism in which producers and appropriators both were absolutely dependent on the market for their most basic conditions of life.
Now, you write in your book, and you just alluded to it now, that the exploitation, which is a necessary part of capitalism, is hidden or opaque in certain ways, unlike the coercion that characterized, say, feudal societies where a naked power seemed to be more apparent. Could you talk about the opaqueness of exploitation under capitalism and what that means for how understandable capitalism has been to, say, the left?
The contrast that you just indicated between capitalism and feudalism is a useful one, because if you think about what the relationship is between a feudal lord and and a dependent peasant. It's a very transparent relationship, which is even legally recognized as a relationship of legal inequality. In capitalism, the capitalist and the laborer begin on the face of it as equals. They're legally equal. And on top of that, the capitalist actually pays the worker instead of transparently extracting surpluses from him. I mean, in the case of feudalism, the peasant is obliged to transfer to do labor services or to transfer surpluses to the lord. Whereas in capitalism, the relationship appears on the face of it to be the opposite, where the capitalist actually pays the worker. So it takes some complicated calculation to figure out how it is that the worker's surpluses are transferred to the capitalist, and how it is that the capitalist derives a profit from the worker's labor.
Let's move on to capitalist imperialism specifically. And you write about a history of empire and different kinds of empire, but I just want to focus on the current form of empire right now. What are the main features of capitalist imperialism?
The main feature of capitalist imperialism is that it operates as much as possible via economic imperatives instead of by direct colonial rule. And I think that, you know, if you had asked anybody before the invasion of Iraq, if you talked about American imperialism before the invasion of Iraq, you would likely meet the objection that, you know, the United States doesn't really possess colonies. It's not a colonial power in the sense that we traditionally understood it. And that is true, and I think it still remains true. I think it still remains true that the United States would prefer to stay out of colonial entanglements and operate its domination through economic imperatives. So I think that the United States is actually the first and so far the only truly capitalist empire which has exercised its domination largely by these economic imperatives, by making subordinate powers subject to economic compulsions emanating from the United States and from American capital.
So in the case of Iraq and the U.S. occupation of Iraq, you would say then that that is more of an exception to this rule, say, of the U.S. trying not to exert a certain kind of territorial empire versus a capitalist empire.
Well, I think the mess that they're making of it in Iraq probably testifies to the fact that they hadn't really intended it to be this way. They hadn't really intended to be an occupying power. What I think they hoped would happen was that they could decapitate the regime and, just install some more compliant leadership and let things get, and then allow American capital to insert itself comfortably into the Iraqi economy, and into the production of oil. And the very fact they've made such a hash of it since then seems to me to prove the point rather than the reverse.
And the U.S. recently, or the U.S.-led leadership in Iraq, I should say, recently announced that it would open up almost the entire Iraqi economy to a privatization, to a certain selling off to private interests.
Exactly.
That would then accord with what you've been saying about economic imperatives or a certain desire to bring Iraq within the U.S.'s economic orbit.
Exactly.
That would accord with your theory.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, that's obviously the preference, and they obviously hoped to be able to do this without having to expend so much energy and resources and lives in a territorial occupation, which is a very risky and less profitable business.
Now, when you say that capitalist imperialism, that its main means of coercion is economic, could you talk a little bit more about that? What is it about capitalism today that allows empire to exist and to perhaps flourish and to expand without the need for military colonization, the placing of settlers in other countries, what used to happen in older empires?
Mm-hmm. You remember when we were talking about the relationship between capital and labor, I talked about the ways in which capital can exercise its domination over labor because labor, The direct producer is market dependent and is obliged to enter the market to sell their labor power simply in order to gain access to the means of life and self-reproduction. Well, in a way, an analogous thing has happened on the global plane, in which more and more parts of the world have been subjected to these market imperatives by making them dependent on entering the market to just gain access to the means of their own self-reproduction. But if you think about the controversies that have been going on recently about agricultural production and, you know, the subsidies that the Americans and the Europeans go in for at the expense of third world producers. I mean, this would not be a problem if these producers in the subordinate economies hadn't been made market dependent in the first place. You know, I mean, for example, some of them have been transformed from subsistence producers into cash crop producers and increasingly forced to orient themselves towards the external market and towards export. And the more they are oriented in that way, the more susceptible they become to the imposition of this kind of domination from the advanced capitalist countries.
Her name is Ellen Maxens Wood. She's author of Empire of Capital, just out from Verso Books. For many years, Ellen was professor of political science at York University in Toronto, and she is a longtime historian and theoretician on the left. We're delighted to have her with us today. She joins us by phone from the UK. Let's develop some historical context for what we're talking about, which you do very well in your book, Empire of Capital. And you distinguish empires of capital, capitalist imperialism, from other kinds of imperialisms that have existed and to some extent flourished in the past for a time. One is empires of property, and for this you cite the ancient Roman Empire and the Spanish Empire in Latin America. What defined these empires?
Well, I selected these two forms of empire, the empire, what I call the empire of property and the empire of commerce, because a focus on property and a focus on commerce are something that we, you know, associate with capitalism, and I wanted to show that it was possible, and historically did happen, that empires could be property-oriented or could be commercially-oriented without being capitalist and without responding to the same capitalist imperatives. The Roman Empire is probably the first really to be grounded in the acquisition of property, of private property. The reason I call the Roman Empire an empire of property is because, first of all, it was responding to the interests of private property classes. In contrast, for example, to empires like the Chinese, in which the central power, imperial power, were office holders, you know, in a bureaucratic state, for whom the state itself represented a primary mode of appropriation. In the Roman Empire, we're talking about property, land, as the source of power. And the empire was constructed on that foundation. It was, I mean, the republic that created this empire was basically an oligarchy of propertied classes, and it was their interests that were being expressed in imperial expansion. And in fact, although they created an imperial state, the imperial state never became the primary source of wealth for the ruling classes. Property was always the objective, and, you know, the state, the bureaucratic, the imperial state, served as an instrument of appropriation indirectly by protecting the expanding private property. And, you know, the Roman Empire was basically one big land-grabbing operation.
So just to be concrete about it, what would the Romans do? They would expand their territory, and how would they, or what would they do with the land that they received by expanding their empire?
Well, first of all, the ruling classes enriched themselves big time. They also, to some extent, used imperial lands to, you know, pacify their own peasant armies whom they had basically been expropriating at home. But they also created local property classes, even in places where they hadn't existed before. So the empire was, in a sense, more a coalition of local landed aristocracies than an imperial state.
Now, if we move on to England, and if we begin to talk about the British Empire, which you see as kind of the first emerging instance of capitalist imperialism, perhaps we should talk about the internal structure of the English economy back then, and specifically about agrarian capitalism, which you go into some depth in Empire of Capital.
Right.
How did capitalism emerge in England? What happened to production and agriculture in that country?
Well, it wasn't, you know, some single moment, some single revolutionary moment that brought about capitalism, but what emerged in the English countryside was a distinctive network of agrarian relations in which tenants held their property on what are called economic leases, increasingly variable according to economic forces and not fixed by custom. This, you know, and whereas you had landlords who became increasingly dependent for their wealth on the competitive productiveness of their tenants rather than on their own superior force. So you had a system in which both appropriators and producers had an interest in increasing the productivity, that labor productivity, by increasingly by technical means, and embarked on this project of what they called improvement, to increase the productivity of agriculture.
Okay, so you just mentioned improvement, and in your book you refer to this, you define it as the idea of improving uncultivated or poorly cultivated land, and you bring up a couple of thinkers and writers in relation to this idea of improvement, because you see improvement as really the ideological justification for seizing the land of others, whether it's others in England or in Ireland or the others of people in other countries. So what did, say, John Locke, the thinker and philosopher, what did he have to say about improvements, about property, and about the value of property?
European imperialism was often justified by claiming that unoccupied land, for example, was available for appropriation, was open to appropriation. The res nullius principle. So that's not that uncommon. It wasn't that uncommon a defense of colonial appropriation. But what happens with capitalism, which is absolutely distinctive, and with the capitalist ideology to which Locke contributed so much, is that it isn't simply a question of unoccupied land being available for appropriation, but rather anything which was not being fruitfully used and productively productively used in terms of English commercial agriculture, by the standards of English commercial agriculture, was itself subject to appropriation, justifiable appropriation. So that, for example, indigenous lands in the Americas, where, you know, the indigenous peoples did not improve their land by the standards of English commercial agriculture and did not increase the exchange value of what they produced, and that's critical. You know, the notion that exchange value is the really central point.
The exchange value being the value of something in a market
Exactly.
Right.
And you know, Locke is very explicit about this. I mean, he indulges in these calculations, and he says something about, you know, if you compare what the Indian produces to what the English, what, you know, people at home produce, there's no comparison in the exchange value of and what the Indian would gain from it in a commercial exchange. And so that, you know, the production of exchange value becomes effectively the basis of property, both domestically and abroad. Now, this doesn't mean that once somebody has, seized a piece of land and rendered it productive, somebody else can come along and, claim it on the grounds that they were going to be able to be more productive still. Locke says that we establish a right to property when we mix our labor with something. But you have to follow the argument a bit further than that, because it isn't just a question of our mixing our labor with something that gives us property, that gives us a right to property. It's rather the extent to which we add to its commercial value by means of rendering it more productive. And that, created a whole new justification for empire, although I have to say that he wasn't the first one to think of it. I mean, there's an interesting document, a fascinating document, which I refer to in my book, by one of the architects of British imperialism in Ireland, a lawyer named Sir John Davies, who, decades earlier than Locke, gave as a justification for seizing Irish land that the Irish themselves were not really using, they were not improving the land. They were not that they weren't cultivating it, because they obviously were. So it wasn't just a question of unoccupied or uncultivated land being open to appropriation, but they simply weren't improving it. They weren't increasing its exchange value sufficiently. And it became the objective of the English imperialism in Ireland to transform Irish property relations in such a way that they could try to reproduce the effects of English agrarian capitalism. Until, of course, Ireland itself threatened to become a competitor, and then they started obstructing Irish development, but that's another story.
Now, we're speaking with Ellen Makesins Wood, for many years professor of political science at York University, Toronto. Her latest book is called Empire of Capital. And if we move into the 20th century, and specifically after World War II, you claim that capitalist imperialism emerged in, would it be fair to say, rather mature form?
After the Second World War?
Yes.
Yes, I think that. I think it was not before the end of the Second World War that it actually emerged in a mature form. And what you get is a two-pronged strategy on the part of the Americans, which on the one hand establishes economic hegemony through the Bretton Woods system, which effectively sets its own conditions on economic development throughout the world. And on the other hand, it establishes itself as the overwhelmingly superior military power by means of the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki towards the end of the war. So you have this two-pronged strategy which has effectively been pursued from then until now. So you might want to ask, what's the connection between this economic hegemony and the military? I mean, if the United States is depending on economic hegemony in a way that an ideal capitalist imperialism should do, why does it need this massive military power? Well, it's a curious thing. I mean, in earlier forms of imperialism, the purpose of military power was pretty obvious. If you're out to capture territory or to defeat imperial rivals, it's clear why you need an overwhelming military power. But if you're trying to establish hegemony over the world by means of your economic power, then why is it necessary to have the most hugely superior, dominant military power the world has ever known? And I think that here we come to a important contradiction about the capitalist imperialism that we've been seeing. What I've been arguing is that capitalist imperialism operates by means of economic power, which is more or less separate from political, military, and legal power. In other words, unlike the feudal lord who depends on his military, legal, and political powers to extract surpluses from the peasant, the capitalist supposedly doesn't. And that makes it possible for capitalist power to extend far beyond the reach of any political or legal or military power. But this doesn't mean that capitalists don't need the support of political and military powers. The trouble is that there is still a growing disparity between the global scope of capital's economic power and the more local powers of administration and coercion that it still needs. I simply don't buy the argument that we've been getting from some globalization theorists and from, you know, people like Hardin Negri and so on, that the more global the economy becomes, the less relevant the nation state is. I think the contrary is true. I think what's really characteristic of globalization is this growing disparity between the global reach of capitalist economic domination and the persistence of the territorial state, which it still needs, because capital needs a orderly, predictable legal and administrative apparatus more than any other social form has ever done. And so far, and in the foreseeable future, it's impossible to imagine that that kind of close legal and administrative regulation is possible on a global scale. So I do not foresee the day when capital will be able to organize the world without the aid of the territorial state. But of course, once you acknowledge that capital still needs this system of multiple states, and that the political form of globalization isn't a global state but a global system of multiple states, you can see that it creates some real possibilities of instability.
Based on the fact that the local states, these poorer countries where we are trying to exert our economic hegemony and in fact have done so, they aren't necessarily going to remain loyal to our cause or to the cause of globalization.
That's right. I mean, and the point is that we need their states to organize an orderly global economy, right? We depend on them all to do that. And the capitalist power, the imperialist power, is constrained. I mean, it can't constantly be going to war with every one of these powers or trying constantly to coerce them by military means, because it would upset the whole climate for capital accumulation. So it has to find ways of imposing this coercion to keep these states in line without depriving them of their capacity for organizing the world for global capital. And this is the real problem for capital and a real weakness, I think, in the long run. I mean, it creates whole new spaces for opposition. I think we may be beginning to see a little bit of this, for example, in what happened in Cancun, which may be one of the, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate the importance of it, but it's certainly the most exciting episode we've seen for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think has happened is that in dealing with this contradiction, the United States has adopted a military doctrine which justifies permanent war without any specific objectives, what I call infinite war, or, you know, war without end in purpose or time. For example, I mean, one of the principal functions of war, the way the Americans now understand it, is the demonstration effect. And they use that phrase themselves, I mean, the Bush regime. The demonstration effect, where you show your massive military superiority without really seeking any particular objective in the way that old imperialist powers did with their military force. You're not, you know, necessarily seeking a specific territory, but you want to create a cautionary atmosphere by means of this demonstration effect, shock and awe. I mean, I think that what happened in Iraq was not just the question of the most obvious impulse to control the oil supply, although that was certainly a major factor, but it was also simply to demonstrate to the world, to shock and awe the world.
And so to elaborate then, what you are saying is that this Bush doctrine of demonstrating enormous military capability and a willingness to use it in order to deter efforts or any temptation to think about contesting or equaling U.S. military power, this is directed not just at rogue states, but at states that are industrialized, that have been quote, allies for us for a long time. This is about keeping those states in line as well?
Absolutely. But, you know, the problem with capitalist competition is that it's not like inter-imperialist rivalry of the traditional kind. You know, I mean, if you're fighting over trade routes, you go and you conquer your rival, and that, you know, the objective is pretty clear. But, you know, you don't have that luxury in advanced capitalism because you need your competitors' markets as much as you're endangered by their competition. So you have to find a new way of controlling allies which doesn't at the same time undermine your own economic power. And, you know, I think that that this has been a longstanding policy of the United States to demonstrate that it is the overwhelmingly supreme military power, which is hardly worth trying to challenge or even to match.
Ellen Mason's words, some commentators, observers, say that this Bush doctrine represents a clear break from prior U.S. policy, that U.S. empire has taken a new turn. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, it's very tempting to say that it does represent a huge break because these people are so extreme. It's hard to find any comparison in the recent past. I mean, certainly on the domestic level where, you know, they're introducing restrictions on civil liberties in ways which, you know, were not only reminiscent of the Cold War, but perhaps in some respects even worse. So on that front, there obviously are certain discontinuities from the recent past. And the ostensible territorial occupation of Iraq does suggest that they may be reverting to an older form of territorial imperialism, but I've already discussed why I don't think that's their objective. So despite the extent to which they've taken their doctrine to unmatched extremes, I do think that you can't make any sense out of what they're doing if you don't consider what went before. I mean, for example, that two-pronged strategy that I talked about before, that's been in place since the Second World War. On the one hand, you know, economic domination through the control of the global commercial systems and financial systems and so on. And on the other hand, is absolutely overwhelming and unmatchable military power. I mean, you know, there's no way that Bush could be doing what he's doing today if that hadn't been an objective, a longstanding objective, if the construction of this overwhelming military power hadn't already been in the works. I think that the logic of the American empire and the contradictions that I've been trying to explain that prevail in it are longstanding, or at least, you know, since the Second World War, and that in that respect, Bush is kind of, you might say that he's kind of followed it to its ultimate and irrational conclusion, but it doesn't make sense unless you see it against the background of what went before.
And finally, you write in your book, Empire of Capital, that this current form of imperial domination, while it may appear all-powerful to some, is actually vulnerable. And the vulnerability stems to some degree from what you were saying earlier about global capitalism in a system of multiple states being the paradigm, the effective way that empire operates today. What about capitalist imperialism today creates opportunities for resistance and for the left?
The reason I say that the state is perhaps more than ever the point of concentration of capitalist powers is because if you think about it, global capital itself, can't organize globalization. It just can't do it. It doesn't do it, and it depends on states to do it for them. So its dependence on this form of territorial and localized power is a vulnerability, and it creates direct targets for opposition in a way that hasn't existed for a very long time. And that means that although obviously oppositional forces in the main imperial powers would be the most effective, nevertheless, other territorial states have their own leverage too because the system is so dependent on them. And, you know, I mean, we all had great hopes, for example, for Lula in Brazil. I mean, so far he's being a bit of a disappointment, but, I think they could do remarkable things as a model of opposition.